Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Amy Newmark, the publisher and editor-in-chief for Chicken Soup for the Soul. Amy and I will be discussing their wonderful edition, Food and Love. The book shares 101 stories of celebrating special times with family and friends. Good morning, Amy. Welcome back to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I am good. I'm very glad to be talking about food so we can warm up together on a winter day.
No kidding. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me on my weekly kitchen hangout. And I have to tell you, Food and Love is a great book. It is the first chicken soup book that made me hungry while reading the story. So congratulations for that.
You're welcome. You know, we made it because we realized we were getting so many stories from people that revolved around food in some way. Because if you think about it, you know, we get stories about all the important human events that occur, you know, marriage proposals and weddings and Valentine's Day and Christmas celebrations and birthdays and college graduations and just Father's Day and Mother's Day and all the special things that happen in people's lives. And if you think about it, all of these milestones and these important events always revolve around food. And so we were getting so many stories about food and how food was such an important part of human relationships that I know it sounds kind of hokey and like what we're always accused of being, like super sweet and heartwarming. But hey, this is reality. This is what people care
about.
Right. And so that's why we said we're going to put out a book just with these stories about food called Chicken Soup for the Soul, Food and Love.
I agree. Sometimes what happens is that in our normal everyday living, food, even though it plays such a significant point in our life, it became the background, basically the backdrop of activities happening on the forefront in terms of building relationship, connecting with other people, and building the camaraderie among friends and so forth. So with this book is that it brings all that to the forefront, which I'm really glad you guys did that.
Food is really part of love. I mean, it starts when you're in the womb and your mother is nurturing you, right? And then you come out and she continues to nurture you with food. And then food is the way that we express our love for people we care about, whether we're feeding family members or friends. It's all so intertwined. And then when we start to, you know, mindlessly eat in the car or put the family in front of the television to eat, we start mindlessly eating and we've removed that whole emotional component from food, which is not only not as good for our emotional well-being, but it's also not as good for our physical well-being because mindless eating, you put on the calories, you don't have that social engagement with your friends and family, you don't connect with people, and so you end up divorcing food from nurturing your soul. You may just be nurturing your body. So I really like the fact that with this book we're reminding people that food and love go together and are part of human relationships. And let's get back to making food part of human relationships, not just tossing it in our mouths as we go through the drive-thru.
No doubt about it. This book allows me to think back on all the times that I spend with my various moms. One in particular, my Southern Belle mom, this is what she had told me a long time ago. Being a mom is like being in the kitchen. It is all about creating and loving. It requires patience, a happy attitude, and a touch of love. When I read your book, somehow those words just came back to me from the various stories that were presented in the book.
Yeah, and I think that for all of us, a lot of our favorite childhood memories revolve around being given food, usually by mothers, but sometimes by grandmothers or other favorite people. And we actually made a whole special for PBS that was shown all over the country in 2014. And I think it's it's continuing to be shown, because I noticed that even though it had its debut in August 2014, the show was on a lot in December also, and I think they're going to keep running it. So this TBS special that we made, which is called Chicken Soup for the Soul, Food and Family, is all about reminding people that food is part of their human relationships. And what we do in the show is we talk about how it has been scientifically proven that eating food with people you care about, whether it's family members or friends, is much more healthy for you. Eating food with people increases your emotional well-being. It causes you to eat less. It makes you weigh less. And when you eat with your family, with kids, the kids do better in school. They aren't as prone to obesity. They aren't as prone to substance abuse. They get along better with their friends at school. They get better grades. I mean, it's amazing all of the scientifically proven benefits of eating food with family or friends. And these benefits extend to children and also to adults. And so we made this PBS special that was based on this book, Food and Love, and based on this whole theme of getting back together around the table. And then a sub-theme of our PBS special was, you know, once we convinced people, okay, you want to get back together around the table with the people you love, then our sub-theme was we showed people how easy it is to whip up meals that are good, that we showed people, here's all you need to keep in your kitchen at all times. Like, here's what your pantry should have in it, here's what your refrigerator should have in it. You just keep these things on hand, and then here's a whole bunch of recipes where you could make a one-pot dish, because it's so much easier if you're throwing everything in one pot, right?
Right.
You make a one-pot dish in like 10 to 15 minutes with these ingredients that you already have in your house and gather everybody around the table. I mean, it's not going to take you any longer than it would have taken to go to KFC and get the big family pack and then bring them home.
Right. The misconception is the fact that we're talking about, oh my gosh, got to cook at home, and you're talking about this full-blown meal is going to take hours to prepare, and the thought process having to cook so many different dishes and so forth, that's just a myth, because you can have a wonderful time, a delicious, nutritious meal well under an hour.
Yeah, and the other thing that we talk about on the PBS show, and this is something that I talk about all the time, is how you can make a big one-pot meal, and then you can put it into single-serve dishes, and you can put it in your refrigerator for later that week or even freeze it. This is what I do all the time. Like, I usually do this on Sundays, Algerian chili or some kind of pasta sauce. And then I have these dishes that are good for microwaving, because, you know, they say you shouldn't microwave in the plastic container.
Right.
So I have, you know, like the Pyrex or whatever, these dishes that have a little rubber top. And they're single serving, and then I portion it out, and then when it's not too hot, I cover them up, stick them in the freezer, and then I just pull them out, and I have this meal. And so that's a super easy way to have meals during the week, even if you are very busy. You just cook too much on a Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, I still have, it's almost 2 months now since Christmas, and I still have some chili left from Christmas in my freezer, which I can pull out and have for dinner.
Yeah, yeah. That's wonderful. You must have spent some time down in Louisiana, because folks down in Louisiana that I spent a lot of time with, we call that cooking gumbo. Throw everything in it in one pot and then just boil it.
You know, that's how I cook. So, I didn't start cooking till I was about 40 years old, because my first husband was a fabulous cook, and so I let him do the cooking. And then I got divorced, and then I had to feed my kids. And I learned how to cook. And I realized that, besides the fact that he was such a good cook, the other reason I hadn't cooked for all those years was I really didn't want to follow recipes. I just wanted to make it up myself. And what I do now is I almost never make the same thing twice. Basically, if I have onions and garlic and some olive oil, I throw those in a pan and I start sauteing them. And then I just start looking around. And I look in my refrigerator. I'm like, oh, you cherry tomatoes, you're getting a little old. All right, you're going in the pot. Oh, this edamame, these frozen edamame beans that I have in the freezer, you know what? Half this bag, you're going in the pot. Oh, this half a canned corn that I have left over, you're going in the pot. And I just start throwing stuff together, and my husband will say, that smells really good. What are you making? And I'll say, I don't know. I have no idea what I'm making. I'll let you know when I'm finished. I don't even know yet if we're serving it over rice, or if we're serving it over pasta, or if we're eating it by itself. But I just look around to see who should dump in the pot. It's like everyone in the pool.
Usually, those are some of the most wonderful dishes. I agree with you because I tend to do that sometimes when I get creative. It's just the blending of the different flavors. It's an original dish. If you ask me to repeat it, most likely I'm not able to. So enjoy the moment.
That's true. Oh, and you know what else I learned? I learned, you know, I love to throw in like some powder, some cumin, you know, some different herbs and spices. And I learned from an Indian guy. He said to me, you need to saute your herbs and spices early. Like when you're sauteing your onions and garlic, that's when you throw your spices in.
That's right.
I throw them in first. Because he said that will really bring out their flavors better.
Right.
It's amazing how a little cumin will dress up a dish and make it seem very fancy. Mm-hmm. You throw cumin in a pot and you can just say, this is my Mediterranean blah, 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 or my Moroccan blah, 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 right?
Right. The word I use is like, this is an island dish. It combines everything. It's got that nice aroma of the island flavors of Jamaican and Caribbean and so forth. So everybody's like, oh, wow, really? Yeah.
That's a good idea. I'll just say the island of North America.
Wonderful. Can you tell us about the cartoon illustrations in the book?
Yeah, you know, we really try to make these books fun. So what's cool about this book is that we have recipes in here for about a quarter of the stories. Every time that somebody talked about like a secret family recipe, we'd go to them and we'd say, okay, we want the recipe. And 100% of the people we asked gave us the secret recipe. So we have all those recipes in here. And then we also have a whole bunch of cartoons by this really wonderful cartoonist named Mark Tyler Nobleman. He's illustrated some of our other books. He's very sophisticated. He's more like a New Yorker kind of cartoonist. And I just love his art, and I love his captions. And so he read all the stories for the book, and then he got really creative and came up with cartoons for a bunch of them. So you'll see a bunch of stories where the food that is referenced in the story, we provide you with the recipe at the end, and then you'll see a bunch of stories that are followed by a very clever cartoon that references something in the story.
As a child, when you were growing up, did you ever spend any time in the kitchen? Because I know some of the stories that I read in the book, they're wonderful stories about relationships being forged at such a very young age.
When I was a kid, I didn't really cook until I was in high school, and then my mother would just ask me to please make dinner for my younger brother and sister, and so she would leave me like chicken and the shake and bake mix or something like that. So I did do a lot of that kind of mass market cooking, but I do remember when I tried to get fancier, it didn't go so well. One time, and the family still talks about this, I tried to make fudge. So my grandmother made really great fudge, so I asked her for the recipe. She gave me the recipe, and I was 12 years old or something, and it was like right after we went to the moon, and so everybody was talking about the moon rocks, and I made this fudge that ended up coming out like black and shiny, and everybody said it looked like moon rocks, but here's what I did wrong, which I didn't realize till 20 years later. I made the whole recipe. Part of the recipe said to put in 2 tablespoons of coffee. So we didn't drink coffee at our house, but my mother had this little jar of revolting, like, I don't know what they were called, like flakes, instant coffee flakes. So I put 2 tablespoons of instant coffee flakes into the fudge ingredients because I didn't know what 2 tablespoons of coffee meant.
Yeah.
And so that's why it came out rock hard and shiny. Imagine it like those coffee flakes just turned into a whole pan of fudge. And it wasn't until maybe 20 years later that I realized, oh, my gosh, I was supposed to put 2 tablespoons of liquid coffee into the mix. Because, you know, my grandmother drank coffee every day American.
Right.
But in my house, nobody drank coffee. So that was my childhood memory of trying to cook. It didn't go so well.
looking back, it's funny, though, the things that we go through. I remember when my mom, and she would never let my sister get away with this, because I remember when we were growing up, she was trying to teach my sister how to cook rice. One evening, she asked my sister to cook rice, and my sister says, "Well, I'm not hungry." So it's like, okay, but the whole family, we have to eat.
That's funny. Your sister must have been a teenager then.
Yeah. She's like, no, I don't want to learn how to cook. I don't want to be in the kitchen. And so that's her comment was like, okay, well, it's all right. I'm not hungry. I'm not going to eat anything. I bet
if you ask your sister now, she'll speak so fondly of what your mom taught her to cook, because that's what we had so many stories where people did talk fondly about their mom teaching them how to cook. But, you know, at the time, they might have been reluctant, obnoxious teenage girls, but it all changed when they remembered it.
Right. That's what this book is all about. So I'm very excited about the book. What would you like for the readers to gain from the various stories?
I think that the most important thing for readers to gain from Chicken Soup for the Soul, Food and Love, would be to reacquaint themselves with their kitchen and to gather their loved ones around the table again, because they'll really enjoy it, even if they provide, you know, the simplest possible meal. Just getting people around the table really is wonderful for everybody. And so I'm hoping that that's what this book will do. It will remind them that they do love being around the table, and it will get them to make it part of their everyday lives.
That's wonderful. I believe the timing for the book is perfect, simply because there are more people in the kitchen now than ever. What I mean by that is that you have the kitchen being an open area, and that's where the heart of the home is. Now you have the interaction between moms and dads and children. Before, in the past, probably in our parents' generations and our grandparents' generation, where the kitchen, it's a no-go zone for the husbands or the children. But now it is truly where everybody gathers and get connected.
That's true. That's true. And you might as well make some good food while you're there, so that it doesn't just turn into a game room or a TV watching room.
That's true. Let us start by talking about all the various stories that I've selected as talking points for this morning. There are so many of them, but I tried to get as many of those wonderful stories in this morning with you. These are stories that I kind of able to make connections to them. Some of them are really funny and some of them are touching, but overall, they are just fantastic stories, and I think people will connect with them. The first one is Learning to Cook. The title of the story is Hockey Pucks by Jacqueline Rifkin.
Yeah, I started the whole book with a chapter on learning to cook because, hey, everybody has to start somewhere, and I thought it was important to let people know that their efforts would be appreciated even if their first attempts to cook were real disasters. And so in this story, Hockey Pucks, Jacqueline talks about the fact that she came home from the hospital with a new baby, and her husband set aside his fear of anything involving food preparation, and he actually tried to cook for her. And she told him that if she could have anything she wanted, she would like some whole grain applesauce muffins. I know if I said to my husband, I would like you to bake whole grain applesauce muffins, he would be absolutely terrified. That would be the worst thing he ever heard. I could just imagine. But anyway, this husband, since his wife had just given him a baby daughter and he was probably still remembering the labor, he said, all right, I'm going to try to do this. And what he created was a plate of hockey pucks. They were just so awful. And he said, I guess they're awful, aren't they? And she just started to cry. And he thought she was crying because they were so awful, but she was crying because she was so grateful to this husband who loved her so much that he would try to make these muffins for her that were just terrible. And so that was the point, was that, hey, just try. It will be appreciated.
There you go. So true about that. The next one is in Learning How to Cook section. The second story that I chose is Unlikely Gourmet by Patty Lawson.
This is another story that's encouraging men to get into the kitchen. We women will really appreciate it, and no matter what you do, we will like it. But in this case, this dad
went into the kitchen and actually cooked something good, although it didn't look very good. It just tasted good. But they had had just gotten satellite television, and all of a sudden this guy who had had no interest in cooking ever became addicted to Bobby Flay on the Food Network.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to barbecue. You know, manly pursuit, right? And so the family went out shopping and came home. Kitchen was an absolute disaster. This guy had managed to use every single pot and pan, and everything was lying around. There were empty ketchup bottles everywhere. The spice cabinet was open, and there were spices everywhere. There were bowls. There were utensils. There were cookie sheets, colanders, skillets, measuring cups. Everything was covered with some kind of red-brown sauce. There was flour all over, sugar, maple syrup, mustard. It was a mess. It was like a hurricane had gone through that kitchen, hurricane husband. And in the middle of it all was this girl's smiling dad wearing an apron, and there was some kind of really revolting pile of meat in front of him. But he was so proud that they said, all right, we're going to try it. We'll pretend we like it. And it turned out it was absolutely delicious. Somehow he had simmered together all these great flavors. And so it took them a long time to clean up the kitchen, but they had one very proud dad there who had actually managed to cook.
It's a wonderful story because we guys, when we can't sleep, we watch cooking shows in the middle of the night. Well, I could try that. I could do this. And so I thought that was a funny story, what he did. And the fact that the result was an excellent meal.
Yeah. A little bit of cleanup, but still a good meal.
The next story is Cooking with Mom by Kimberly No.
So, of course, this was the more traditional way that people learned to cook, whether they were boys or girls. They mostly mm-hmm. learned to cook from their moms and sometimes from their grandmothers. So Kimberly talks about how her mom started teaching her when she was only 4 years old, and her mom was actually a professional, and so she worked at a donut store. And so when she was 6 years old, her mom would take her in the middle of the night to the donut store, and she would lie there on a lounge chair and, you know, sleep on and off while her mom and dad were making donuts. And then she just talks about at each age how she learned how to cook. At 18, she made her first fried chicken with mashed potatoes. She did start a fire in the kitchen, but her date, who was sitting in the living room, had no idea that had happened. And as she got older, her mom continued to teach her. Like when she was 28, her mom showed her a trick to make her famous pies because her mom was such a good baker. And so she just talks about how over the years she learned everything from her mom. And then when her mom, you know, got older and was downsizing and moving, Kimberly went and took all of her mom's kitchen stuff, like her old glass mixing bowls and her copper measuring cups and her mm-hmm. old pie plates, because she said she wanted to always cook with her mom's old equipment so that her mom would always be there with her in the kitchen.
It's a wonderful story. It reminded me of my various moms when I was having quality time talking to them in the kitchen. They will all tell me that they started cooking around the age of 5-6 years old. What drove them was the fact that they were just simply curious at that age. How do I do this? How do I do that? And before you know it, their mothers will get them engaged into doing something to contribute to the meal. And that's how they began their cooking, I wouldn't say career, but learning how to cook for themselves and so forth.
You know, it's a wonderful strategy for moms to use, too.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you have more than one kid, you could say, all right, whoever helps me in the kitchen gets special time. You know, and then you could have one-on-one with one kid at a time
yeah.
who helps you with
yeah.
dinner.
Yeah.
So it's a really nice way to carve out some special time with your children. And you're doing a project together. They're learning, but you're also talking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So true. The next section is Just Like Mom. The first story is Jess Legacy by Sandra Brinker.
Sandra Brinker is interesting. I met her because I read a couple of books that she mm-hmm. wrote. One of them, I think, was on special on Amazon, you know, as an ebook, and I
mm-hmm.
bought it and read it, and I got in touch with her, and I said, I love your writing. You should write for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so she wrote this story for us about
her mom, Jess, and she said that her mom had always loved her red and white Betty Crocker cookbook, and unfortunately, she lost it in one of those really bad storms in Florida, and it wasn't just the cookbook, but it was all the notes that she had in the cookbook. You know, it was almost like a diary of cooking throughout her entire life. And Sandra actually was trying to get her mom a replacement, but of course, even if she had found the same cookbook again, it wouldn't have had all the notes. But anyway, then her mom died, and it was before Sandra could get her that replacement cookbook. But Sandra was cleaning out her mom's desk, and she found a red and white notebook that looked a lot like the cookbook, and opened it up and discovered that her mom had been trying to handwrite for her a new cookbook. So her mom was trying to replace the Betty Crocker cookbook also that she had been intending to leave to her daughter. And so all the pages were neatly numbered, and there were some recipes in there, and then they stopped, and there were still numbers on the blank pages. And Sandy realized that her mom never got to finish it. So the book started out, it said, "For my daughter Sandy." There was a handwritten table of contents, and not all the recipes were in there that went with the table of contents. And so Sandy says that one of her friends recently told her about a beautiful piece of jewelry that she inherited from her grandmother, and it was appraised at more than $12,000. And Sandy says, "Too bad she doesn't have what I do, because this cardboard notebook that's half filled with recipes is absolutely priceless to her. And it's a wonderful legacy from her mom." Recipes are an incredible legacy that we leave to our kids. And I think all moms have that impulse to start writing them down, because that's what your family tradition revolves around, is those favorite foods.
That's right. When you prepare those meals during family get-togethers, they bring back all the wonderful memories. And to me, that's what you talk about just now, leaving a true legacy of love that passes on from generations to generations.
That's right. I know that you picked out a story by April Knight.
Yes.
And what I loved about this is that April Knight talks about an honorary mom. And I know that you have a lot of honorary moms.
Yes.
Right? And so April talks about going home to visit Aunt Marge. And April had grown up in a broken home, not like you. You grew up in a wonderful home. It was just in Malaysia, not in the United States. But April really had an Aunt Marge, and Aunt Marge became like her honorary mom. And so she starts off the story talking about how she's going to visit her Aunt Marge, and she loves Aunt Marge's cooking. And Aunt Marge greets her when she visits and says, "I cooked all your favorite foods." And then all of a sudden, we're surprised, because April goes on to say, she had cooked a meatloaf that was burned and crusty around the edges, and she made lumpy mashed potatoes and half-cooked corn on the cob. She had sliced tomatoes and cucumbers and doused them in vinegar. And for dessert, she had baked a chocolate cake that had fallen in the middle. It was the exact meal she had cooked for April many times. And April says, "It was perfect. It was my favorite meal because Marge was my favorite person." And then she goes on to say the next morning her Aunt Marge fixed her favorite breakfast: extra sugar in the coffee and burned toast. And so it was just so cute that April's memories of her Aunt Marge and all these terrible foods were still so warm. Because April concludes her story saying it was never about the food, it was about the love. And it just shows people won't even matter what you cook. It's the fact that you made the food with love and you were trying to nurture them. And even if you're not the greatest cook in the world, they'll still love you for it.
When you cook food like that on a one-to-one basis, you do put a lot of thought into what you're preparing, because you are really trying to make connections. What I like about that story is that's what really matters. It's not what food you're being served, it's the person you're with, the connection that you're building. That's what matters.
And the fact that you tried to nurture, because, I mean, I had a baby shower a few days ago for one of our editors who just had twins, and we did it as a potluck at my house. So I just supplied all the beverages, which included very delicious Prosecco with pomegranate liqueur in it, because we took a soup for the soul ladies
we were able to drink that on Sundays. but everybody brought food, and it was so nice because everybody got to show our editor, who had just had twins, love in their own way by bringing a special dish of their own. And everybody loved the fact that they could bring a dish of their own because we all wanted to express their love, and we did it not just through giving her baby presents, but also through bringing the food.
It's very interesting. The next section is Table for Two. The first story I thought is really, really cute. Mango Love by Lavar Mueller.
Yeah, so a lot of dating, of course, involves food, right? Like, you don't really go on a date without eating something together.
Right, right.
And Lava was on her first date with a guy who she thought was very promising. And so she had suggested that before they went to the movie he invited her to, that they should have a little picnic. So she gathered together half a loaf of bread, a block of cheddar cheese, and then she had a mango that had, she just had this one mango in her house, and it was perfectly ripe. And so she said, oh, I'm going to bring that also. And so they ate the mango together, and it was really messy, but it was delicious, and she was happy that he liked it. And unfortunately, she dropped a slice of it onto the ground, and the ants immediately got all over it. And then her date reached into his bag and pulled out another mango, and she just couldn't believe that he had brought a mango also, because that is pretty random, right? And she says, and she concludes the story by saying, today, whenever we eat a mango, the kids ask us to tell the story about the first date. Mm-hmm. So they ended up getting married, and, you know, it's been a long time now, and they have kids, and it all started with those mangoes, and mangoes will always be very special to them.
See, what we do as guys, we plan all that stuff to make the right first impression.
Well, he did a good job.
The next Table for Two story, it's wonderful. Honeymoon Muffins by Tim Ramsey.
So this is another guy in the kitchen story, and this is really funny because Tim was a teacher. So he had 3 months off in the summer, and one summer he got married, and he and his new wife moved to a new home, and then she had to go back to work because she only got 2 weeks of vacation while he got 3 months before the new school year would start. So she went to work, and he was home, nothing to do, so he decided to cook muffins, and it went pretty well, and so then he started cooking all different kinds of muffins, and before they knew it, he was baking dozens of muffins every day, and they were overwhelmed with muffins, and he made 10 different flavors of muffins, and she finally said to him, please, no more muffins. And so the muffins ended up in the freezer, but I thought it was funny because it's a really good example of a husband being rather exuberant in the kitchen and just going overboard. Which definitely happens. We've all had that experience. And the wives have to think of a way to politely dial back down the enthusiasm and get the husband out of the kitchen.
And, of course, he was trying to build a relationship with his mother-in-law as well, sending her some muffins, too.
That's true. That's true. He did do that. That's right. And the mother-in-law was very polite about that. Thank you. I really needed 5 dozen muffins.
The next section is comfort food. I really like this particular story, Battered Love by Linda Wright.
Yeah, so you like the stories about the guys going crazy in the kitchen, because this is another one where the husband went a little crazy. So in this case, Linda and her husband went to the local warehouse club, and her husband bought a 10-pound bag of buttermilk pancake mix. And it was just the two of them. They really didn't need 10 pounds of pancake mix. And she read the bag, and she said to him, this makes 250 pancakes. Are you crazy? And he said, yeah, but it works out to only 9 cents a day for breakfast, so we should do that. It was so funny. I mean, that's such a typical husband thing to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then he had to justify making all these pancakes. So he starts cooking, like, he cooks all the pancakes, and he starts making, like,
two pancakes, single, like little plastic bags. So he's like packing two pancakes at a time in Ziploc bags and then putting a bunch of Ziploc bags and freezing them and then saying, and now we'll just take out one bag at a time when we need breakfast and we'll just heat it right up. And so they ate pancakes for a long, long time, but she had to admit that they were really, really good. And she finally became enthusiastic also because he was so proud of what he had done. So another great example of a husband being exuberant and the wife ending up being polite about it and then proud of him and cooperating. But really, the guys out there listening, we don't need 250 pancakes.
Well, I look at it this way. He was watching the nickels and dimes. They were retired. They were trying to save some money. And, of course, it's closer to home than you think because, don't forget, you cook once a week and then you're thawing everything out the rest of the week.
That is true. That is true. I agree with you there.
Anyway, so it's just a funny story, I think. We guys like to manage everything. So now when we're in the kitchen, it's not a spontaneous thing. So we have to manage it.
Right, right.
The next section is Little Helper, Tough Love in the Kitchen by Cynthia Briggs.
So this is a whole chapter about getting the kids involved with cooking. Mm-hmm. And this story by Cynthia Briggs is a twist on that because Cynthia staged a cooking strike. She was tired of her 9-year-old and her 11-year-old complaining. Oh, Mom, you made that again, or do we have to have chicken, or whatever it was. She said, I'm going on strike. You kids are just going to have to cook for yourselves. And she went on strike for weeks, and her kids ended up begging her to come back and cook for them, and they were very grateful after that for what she cooked for them. And so I just thought it was very amusing, and I think going on a cooking strike is a great idea for a mother who has ungrateful children.
That story reminded me about my sister and I when we were growing up. There was one incident where my sister and I, actually, we weren't complaining about the food, but what happened was I liked to pick on my sister, and so we were fighting all the time. One day, my mom wanted to punish both of us by deciding not to cook dinner that night. Needless to say, our dad got upset with us because we all ended up eating soup for the evening rather than a nice cooked meal. It just sort of reminded me when I read that story about the cooking strike.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The kids should be grateful.
The next section is In Memory Of, Getting to Know Jennifer by Gina Lee Gifford.
So this is a whole chapter about the wonderful memories we have and the recipes that are left behind by people who have passed on. And this is one of my favorite stories in the whole book. And in fact, we featured this story in the special TV show that we made for the national, you know, public television stations. So in this case, Gina Lee Gifford, who's actually a food writer down in Florida, she married a man who had lost his wife at a young age to lung cancer. And this man had three really adorable little daughters. And Gina came into this family and found Jennifer's cookbook. And it was like many people's cookbooks. It had little notes about things and like notes about where recipes came from. You know, this was my aunt's favorite, that kind of thing. So Gina got to know Jennifer by cooking her recipes. And she started making these special recipes for Jennifer's girls who she had left behind. And Gina would even call Jennifer's mother and get help with some of the recipes that, of course, had come from her. And so I thought it was so moving. And what Gina says at the end of the story is that she will carry on the legacy and cook the foods that Jennifer cannot, because this is what we do. And so I think it's a beautiful story that she was taking care of her stepdaughters by cooking for them the recipes left behind by their mother.
So true. It's just such a compelling story about, again, relationships. It has no boundaries. It's all about feeding the soul.
Yeah, I really liked it a lot. And it just shows how recipes are a true legacy that we leave behind, way more important than any material possessions that we could leave. Mm-hmm. And the next story is about that, too, because in this story, Anne-Marie Tate talks about how her mom had her come over one day, and her mom taught her her chicken and dumpling recipe and really forced her to learn it. And then her mom kind of casually mentioned that she was going to go to the doctor in a few days. And it turned out her mom kind of knew that she had something very wrong with her, and she went to the doctor, and it turned out she had lung cancer, and she only lived 3 more months. And so Anne Marie says at the end of the story, though she never let on, I know in my heart Mom planned that cooking lesson because she suspected her days were numbered. She wanted me to have a lasting memory that would forever bring a smile to my heart. Very moving story. It just shows how intertwined food and love are. Her mother knew that her days were numbered, and so she taught her this favorite recipe. They had that special time in the kitchen together, and it was her mom's way of saying, you know, I love you, and this is one of the things I'm leaving with you.
When we talk about living a legacy of love, it's not about material. It's about knowledge. It's about love. And that is a soul-to-soul connection because you speak through food, which is a sustenance of life.
Absolutely. We also have a lot of funny stories in the book before you and I just start crying over these heartwarming stories. We do have the funny ones, too.
Oh, yeah.
And I know you love this one called Pickled Egg Surprise.
Yes.
By Jeannie Dotson. I know you picked it out. And I don't know, are pickled eggs a thing in Malaysia? Do you pickle a lot of foods there?
They pickle a lot of food, but it's pickled eggs, pickled pig's feet, all the stuff that I don't eat.
Yeah, I've never had a pickled egg either. I don't know if it's a southern thing, but in this story,
it is
Jeannie talks
thing.
About...
Yeah.
Is it? Okay, you know that because you've lived
thing.
In the South.
Yeah.
So Jeannie was like a new wife, and she decided to make pickled eggs for her husband because that was one of her mother-in-law's big things, and Jeannie wanted to show she could cook like her mother-in-law, so her husband was thrilled that he saw this big jar of pickled eggs. And so I guess they were watching football or something. So game day came, and she presents her husband with the pickled eggs. She stuck raw eggs in the pickling. She didn't hard boil them. She didn't peel them. She just took raw eggs, just put the eggs right in the pickling.
Yeah.
And so her husband just wrapped his arms around her, laughing hysterically, and said, I love you. And so this was, one of her early wife cooking disaster stories.
The first sentence grabbed me. My mother-in-law was my biggest competition when it comes to cooking. That's the number one thing usually a lot of times. I don't know about this generation, but I know when I talk about my mom's generation, that it's a big thing for them. I don't know whether it's in America, but certainly in Asia, because the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. And of course, moms babied their baby boys, obviously. So when a daughter-in-law comes into the picture, let's see what she can do. Let's see whether she can feed my son the way I can feed him.
So true. That's why I will never try to cook a Lebanese dish. Because I could never compete with my mother-in-law's cooking.
So I thought it was a wonderful story to talk about. Believe it or not, whether it's a friendly competition or not, it's just fun.
That's true.
The next one, the same category we talk about, Badger Meatloaf by Mitchell Kine.
So Mitchell talks about how she had her brother-in-law stay in her house. He was pet-sitting for her. And her brother-in-law and her husband were real outdoorsmen. You know, they would go out and cook up all kinds of stuff that they killed. Like, they ate rabbit, they ate squirrel, even rattlesnake, venison, elk, caribou, whatever. And so she came home one time and found in the refrigerator something labeled badger meatloaf. And so that could even eat, even though she was used to eating all of this roadkill, basically. And so she tossed the badger meatloaf in the trash. She even asked her husband if badgers were native to Pennsylvania, but he wasn't really paying attention. And then one day she was sitting around the table with her husband and her in-laws, and she told them about finding the badger meatloaf. And all of a sudden, a light went on in her head. And she realized they had friends named Don and Ellen Badger. The Badger family had given them some meatloaf. And she had tossed it out, thinking it was Badger meatloaf.
I thought that was so funny, because it's just like what would happen when the mom is not as unconventional as the rest of the boys into eating wild game meat.
Yeah, I thought it was funny, too.
The next section is Taste of Tradition. This is a nice, wonderful, heartwarming story. A Daughter's Toast to a Father's Bagel by Priscilla Don Courtney.
So here's a fun fact. Priscilla was my best friend when I was a little kid.
Oh, cool.
And then we lost track of each other because, you know, I am in my 50s, and so I wasn't, you know, we weren't friends during the time of the internet and everything. And
yeah.
I lived in, you know, I lived on the East Coast. She moved out to Colorado, and so I lost touch with her. And then maybe 10 years ago, I went on the internet and I found her, and we got back in touch with each other, and she's a writer. And so she started submitting stories for Chicken Soup for the Soul books. And even though she was my best friend in childhood, I don't take all her stories. I take maybe half the stories she submits.
Yeah.
But this is one of the stories that I took. And the funny thing is I've learned a lot about her from reading the stories. For example, in this story, she talks about eating bagels every Sunday growing up. Well, I was in that kitchen. Because I used to sleep over at her house all the time and ate the bagels that her father made. And so I'm like revisiting my own childhood, reading her story about her childhood. It's just so funny that I was there. But she talks about how her dad always made bagels for them. And then when her parents divorced, her father would still provide her with bagels. And then when she went to college, her father would FedEx bagels to her. And she moved out to Colorado, and her father was still in New York, and he was still FedExing bagels from H&H out to her.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on forever. And then finally, where she lives in Colorado, they actually got a good bagel store. And one day, she told her dad, "I don't need the bagels anymore." And her dad got really, really quiet and said, "Oh." And then she realized, oh my gosh, he loved giving me the bagels.
Right.
And
yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of sad because I guess if she'd known, maybe she never would have told him that she didn't need the bagels anymore. But he was spending a lot of money to FedEx bagels to her. And so I thought it was really sweet. And it shows, like, moms nurture through all this food that they cook and maybe through passing on a recipe and then giving cooking advice to a grown daughter. But for a dad, this was how he could nurture his little girl, by FedExing her bagels.
It's not about the bagel as much as it's about the relationship, the connection, the feeling of being able to contribute to his daughter's happiness in maintaining that wonderful relationship. That's what I thought when I read that story.
Yeah, and I think it also reminds all of us, accept those gifts of food and act happy, even if you're not. Because you're really doing a favor to the person. Well, I remember...
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. My first husband had an Italian grandmother. Like, she didn't even speak any English, even when she was here for 60 years. And she would make the worst Italian cookies. They were hard as a rock. They were horrible. And she would just make dozens of them. And so every family get together, she'd bring these awful cookies. And at night, when she had gone to bed early, we'd get all these cookies, which we called landfill.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd throw them in the compactor and then throw other stuff on top of them, and we'd try to dispose of them.
Yeah.
And then she would think we ate all the cookies at night.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it encouraged her to keep making them, but it was this never-ending cycle where we had to throw them away when she wasn't looking. And then, of course, she'd make more, and then we had to keep disposing of them. But it made her happy.
Right.
So it was really important. We never told her that we didn't eat the cookies.
Right. Because it's an act of love from her end.
Yeah. Yeah, even though if we had eaten them, we would have all needed to go to the dentist. Of course, her son, my father-in-law, was a dentist. So maybe this is all a synergistic circle. Eat
there
grandma,
you go.
Crack your tooth, go to the dentist.
There you go. Keep it all in the family, you see.
That's right.
The next taste of tradition is a wonderful story, Memory Meals by Miriam Hill.
Yeah, so this is a good example of, you know, of how we carry those legacies on with us of those favorite meals. And though this Miriam had children who were grown, her daughter was moving away, and her daughter, you know, thanked her for making her favorite meal before she left. And Miriam said, oh, my gosh, I'm going to make recipe boxes for all my kids. And so she bought 3 boxes. She bought index cards. She carefully wrote out all the recipes, and she made boxes for each of her kids. And her kids absolutely loved it. They all used them. They all got to have their favorite family meals now in their own kitchens. And it was a way for her to go with her kids into their new home.
What I like about the story, again, when we talk about sharing wonderful times about family, growing up, and so forth, you really can't find any bad spots when you talk about food. That's what brings everyone together at the dining table.
That's true. I don't think people have unhappy memories about food. It's always good.
The next section is Life's Lessons in the Kitchen. Everything I Would Need to Know by Barbara Ann Burris.
This is a great reminder for parents that you can teach your kids a lot in the kitchen. You can hang out together and cook together, and you can talk about anything you want, the cooking or anything else in life. But working together in the kitchen really does teach you a lot about life, right? You learn budgeting, you learn measuring, you learn preparation. You learn about nurturing and putting your best effort into something to make other people happy. You learn about sharing. And in the case of this writer, Barbara Ann Burris, she learned to respect her mother because her mother was a professional chef. And Barbara was being a typical, you know, annoying teenage girl and trying to get out of going to school. She was 14 years old, and her mom said, you're sick? Really? Okay, so you're not going to school? Fine, you're going to work with me. So Barbara had to get up with her at, you know, 5 in the morning and go to work with her, go to pick up goods at a bakery, then go to the deli and help her mom all day. And she ended up having to work in that deli a lot and in her mom's catering business. And she says, in time, I understood my mom's tenacity and determination to fulfill the dream. And this girl learned about overhead costs and marketing and scheduling and payroll. And she says, most importantly, she learned about faith and determination, about hard work, about responsibility, and about caring for her customers. And so she said that wordlessly over pies and cakes, canapes and sandwich loaves, my mom explained to me everything I would need to know in life. And I think that fits really well with your show, Johnny, right, In My Mama's Kitchen, because you're really pointing out how you learn everything you need to know about life by hanging around in the kitchen with mom.
Yeah. That's why I chose that story, because it reminded me a lot about sometimes things that we don't think about so seriously, but when we're in the kitchen and before you know it, you're learning about life. You're learning about relationships. You're learning about people. And the many, many ways that you can relate that to food and the preparation of food and everything else that you do in the kitchen that you can apply in everyday living. So that's a wonderful story from that perspective. The final story, it's a beautiful story. The title of that chapter is All This Room for Dessert. The story is The Sweetness of Life by Cynthia Common.
Yeah, so this is the last story in the book. And while this chapter is about dessert, I would say this story is not only about dessert, but it's about ending life. Because in this story, we start out, we're in the church, and we're at a funeral, and the minister is talking. And the writer of this story, Cynthia Hammond, is thinking about the woman who's passed away named Ruth, and how Ruth became her first customer when she opened up an exercise studio. And Ruth would come into the studio every day and started leaving chocolate for all the other members who were exercising. And so when you finished your exercise, you get a little piece of chocolate that another member, Ruth, left for you. And one day, Ruth didn't come in. And Cynthia was very concerned because Ruth was such a regular. And it turned out that Ruth had acute leukemia, went to the hospital, died within 2 days. which does happen. This happened to one of my aunts. She had, they called it galloping leukemia, and she died within days of being diagnosed. It was unbelievable how fast it was. But anyway, Cynthia says that Ruth's chocolate tradition continues now, and new members of the exercise studio are often surprised when they see a dish of chocolate by the door. And then she shares with them the story of her first member, Ruth, and how Ruth wanted to make sure that everybody tasted the sweetness of life every day after they did their exercise.
It's just a beautiful story. Totally beautiful story. What stories moved you the most?
There was a story in here by one of our regular writers named Chanel Eliason. And Chanel talks about the fact that, I don't know why I keep talking about obnoxious teenage girls, but they seem to have popped up in this book a lot. Don't really know why, except that it's a common affliction. But in this case, Chanel was having a terrible day. She'd had a bad day at middle school, and she took it out on her mom, even though it had nothing to do with her mom. She was really awful to her mom, and then she felt really bad about it. And she was up in her room just feeling terrible, and her mom was so wonderful. She knew not to take it personally, and she knew that her daughter hadn't meant it. And she came up to her daughter's room, and she said, "Honey, why don't you come down to the kitchen?" And earlier that day, Chanel had had a tantrum because her mom wouldn't make hamburgers, and she wanted hamburgers. And she went down to the kitchen late at night, and she apologized to her mom, and she said, "I've been awful to you today. I had a bad day at school, and I took it out on you, and you didn't deserve it. I'm so sorry." And her mom made her hamburgers and french fries and a milkshake, and they sat together in the kitchen, and Chanel talked to her mom about her bad day, and her mom gave her her love and her forgiveness and her acceptance of her being, you know, a bad teenage girl at a temper tantrum by feeding her. And I just thought that was such a sweet story, and it is a great way for a mom to express love to a teenager who's going through a rough time.
Definitely. That's a beautiful story. Well, it is the time of the hour. What is the recipe for living you would like to share with all our listeners this morning?
Well, I have some great tips that I pulled together from the stories in this book. And one is that recipes really are your legacy. So it's super important to make sure that you share those recipes with your family members so that they have them. You never know, you know, what's going to happen. And so it's important to share those recipes as you go through life. If someone asks you for a recipe, hand it over. And then I think another really important lesson from this book is that it's not what you cook. It's the love that you cook it with. And that applies not just to cooking, but to anything you do in your life. It's the effort you put into it, the caring that you show, whether it's driving somebody somewhere or making them a special hand-drawn card or cooking for them or whatever you do. And then another thing is always be open to life lessons, whether they're in the kitchen or somewhere else. But hanging out with somebody in their environment and doing something together, you can really pick up a lot of lessons about life. Another lesson that I picked up from the book is to pass traditions down to the next generation, whether it's traditions about cooking, whether it's traditions about making a snowman in the backyard, or how you celebrate birthdays, some stupid song that your family has to sing at every birthday, whatever it is, pass down those traditions, because no matter how silly they are, they actually do matter to the next generation. And then finally, I think a great lesson from the book is that you are capable. You can tap into your inner creative self, whether it's cooking something that you had no idea that you could make, or whether it's doing some other creative project, but we all have that creativity lurking inside ourselves.
Those are beautiful recipes for living. Thank you so much, Amy, and thank you for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, please join me in 2 weeks on Tuesday, March 10. My guest will be the Juice Lady, Cherry Claiborne. She is also the author of 27 books, including several bestsellers. Cherry and I will be discussing her latest book, The Juice Lady's Anti-Inflammation Diet. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Amy, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day. And by the way, bon appetit.
Thank you so much. You too.
Take care. Bye-bye.